All right.
I think we can start. It's 12:15. I'd like to thank the National Lawyers Guild chapter here, Chris Schlag, for allowing me to present this information. This is a presentation I gave at Apollo, Pennsylvania last night to the community in what was a much less attractive facility than this, a volunteer fire hall. And the slides that I've been running in this loop, which we're not going to discuss in detail, are some interesting quotes that have been made, everyone from Lyndon Baines Johnson to Henry Kissinger to nuclear researcher Abner Cohen, about the diversion, or what's called the NUMEC, or alternatively Apollo affair. This is the suspected diversion of weapons-grade uranium from a U.S. contractor in the 1960s. And everyone from high officials at the CIA speaking off the record to members of Congress over the past decades have commented based on information that's public and much of it that's not public about the ongoing fallout from this affair. So what I'd like to do before we jump into all of that is just explain briefly the organization I work for. It's a nonprofit 501c3 out of Washington that launched on Capitol Hill, the Rayburn House office building in 2003, gathering together a bunch of less than frequently consulted experts to comment on the rationale behind the invasion of Iraq. We rely in our efforts to declassify information and kind of uncover. Is my mic on? Can everyone hear me okay? Okay. Uncover secret agreements and the organizations that have the greatest impact on lobbying for Middle East policies. We rely a great deal on the Freedom of Information Act and mandatory declassification reviews. And I want to talk about how that environment has improved drastically and what the implications of that are. But we also rely on pro bono lawyers for referrals and support to go up against some of the biggest lobbies and law firms in Washington, D.C. And it's been amazing to me how effective that can be, particularly when there's grassroots public involvement. My background, just briefly, is in international relations with a business background in international management. I've done research in 40 countries, mainly looking at new industry entrants, regulatory environments, supply chain, competitive advantage, comparative advantage, and public policy on behalf of Yankee Group Research in Boston, Marketing Department of American Express, Financial Services, and a business school in Columbia. This has given me an edge in writing the first and only so far, but probably not the last, book about the NUMEC affair called Divert. So everything in this presentation that I'm going to be going through somewhat rapidly is footnoted in almost 500 footnotes in Divert, referencing many documents that we were the first ones to declassify. Of the two reviews, one from a friend who's a radio host in California calls it a whodunit. The other calls it a police blotter, a former State Department official who's now a radio host. I'm not here to sell this. In fact, I gave away most of the copies in Apollo last night. But why even study the NUMEC diversion? I think it's important because we've backed into it by looking at a lot of the organizations in the background and some of the regulatory failures that allowed them to essentially achieve one of the greatest heists in American history and certainly in the nuclear field. we've also run smack dab into NUMEC because of the ongoing policy of what's called strategic ambiguity. And this is, of course, the policy where the United States doesn't declassify documents having to do with ours and Israel's stance on their nuclear weapons. So many of you will remember when the reporter asked Barack Obama, hey, are there at present, amidst all of this hype about Iran's nuclear program, do you think there are any countries in the region that actually have weapons? And Obama observed strategic ambiguity by ducking the question. So this is an issue that affects people in Apollo, people in Pittsburgh, people in the U.S., and people all over the world, and it's tied together. And as I mentioned, new executive orders on freedom of information have the chance to finally break down strategic ambiguity and allow a more informed discussion of the reason for continuing this old policy. This is a slide which keeps going out of date. It's about the consequence of what happened in Apollo, Pennsylvania. This slide says there's a $250 million cleanup going on of this small front company that didn't have enough capital to do what it said it was going to do, which was producing nuclear fuel for the Navy. And the continued failure of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to contract appropriate cleanup because they keep running into unexpected challenges. They don't know enough about what actually happened there to clean it up. Well, that has now ballooned into a $500 million potential taxpayer liability, which you and I get to pay for, amidst ongoing private suits over radiation poisoning and wrongful death. And so this is ballooning into a multi-billion dollar problem just a little bit north of Pittsburgh. And one of the things that came up in the Apollo meeting last night was a trick question. Because they also, in addition to having suffered toxic fallout, have continually been denied access to information about the cleanup, about the history of the site. And so the trick question is, what's worse, being poisoned or being gagged? It's a trick question because the residents of this particular borough are poisoned and gagged, and they have no way out until there's some major changes. Why is this a cover-up then? Well, in doing research about the New Mech affair, what you find is that bona fide, genuine establishment news reporters have been filing requests for the top shelf, most secret CIA documents for decades, and have been continually denied access. So the government is mostly passive in covering this up. And this started, by the way, with Lyndon Baines Johnson. And the former operators and people behind the scenes who are responsible for this are mainly active. And you can see their movements in the court system and in public pronouncements through the decades. And they're still going on. When you look at any news report about New Mech, and there's one almost every other month in the Pittsburgh Gazette, what frequently happens is they don't provide any context about this particular operation, such as who formed it, what were the founders' beliefs, how long did they own it, when was this company, New Mech, transferred to another owner, how and why did it change ownership, and what did the investigators say privately about what happened there. All of this gets glossed over as the big race for cleanup contracts goes on and various contractors jockey for position. But the actual problem that caused the nuclear contamination is almost never addressed. So here's one of the key figures of the New Mech affair, a brilliant scientist from Johns Hopkins University, PhD in chemistry. When he was working at Westinghouse Research Labs, he quickly obtained 6 patents, became a key figure for solving key design issues on the Nautilus nuclear submarine program earning him the worship almost of Hyman Rickover, who was in charge of pushing through this key program of the Cold War. And he's still getting patents. He's still around for his work. He is definitely still a brilliant chemist. He formed NUMEC in Pennsylvania with two partners and $4,500 back in 1956. So this is an amazing figure. His key partner, Leonard Pepkowitz, worked closely with Robert Oppenheimer on the Manhattan Project. But how do you start a nuclear processing company with $4,500? How do you suddenly get government contracts? How do you begin to put together the infrastructure to process fuel for the Navy? Behind NUMEC was a larger facilities organization with some very interesting people on its board of directors. Santoy Mining Company was an outfit that had been mining in Mexico, American Nut and Bolt Fastener Company, and Apollo Steel Company, a defunct huge plant in the center of Apollo, which had fallen on hard times when steel demand began declining right after World War II. The employees of this steel company continually tried to get it back up and running with employee buyouts, and trying to infuse it with viability. But the last time before it became the backdrop of NUMEC that it changed hands, it was listed as a business worth $500, basically a sprawling facility made for forging steel. On the board of directors of this larger facilities industry, you had Zalman Shapiro, you had Elliot Finkel, a corrupt Department of Justice official who had been caught being on two sides of cases in bankruptcy, simultaneously prosecuting and defending defendants. He was kicked out, or eased out, before he could be fired. He went on to become a major figure in the ADL, Anti-Defamation League. Ivan Novick, the brash and outspoken future head of the Zionist Organization of America, the national president. And David Lowenthal, a man whose key background was his connection to high officials in Israeli intelligence and his smuggling career before he launched Apollo. So this is the fascinating part about NUMEC, the cast of characters whose backgrounds were not generally known when the business was up and running, which have only really become clear recently through declassification of Justice Department documents. I think the ZOA connections are extremely relevant. Here in Pittsburgh, activists who were lobbying for the creation of a state in Palestine were leaders of the movement, and they frequently fought with the Justice Department, which ordered them seven times to register as foreign agents because they were so active in getting special treatment for this cause from the World Zionist Organization. But they ultimately got a break in 1948, and this may have given them the feeling that they could do much more in terms of avoiding foreign agents registration and getting the ultimate weapon to Israel. The Foreign Agents Registration Act, as you probably know, is still in effect, not as ruggedly enforced as it used to be, but it requires anybody who wants to work for foreign governments or foreign nonprofits even, or foreign lobbyists, to register with the Justice Department, and it was very effective in targeting Soviet and Nazi front groups set up in the United States. One of the key figures in the backdrop of NUMEC was this man. This is the former Zionist Organization of America president who gave David Lowenthal, a key figure in Apollo Industries, his first job as a smuggler. Sonnenberg, with the help of other major figures, met with David Ben-Gurion before the formation of the state and set up a vast archipelago of smuggling fronts across the United States designed to get all sorts of war material for the upcoming fight for independence. This included a baby flat-top aircraft carrier from the War Assets Administration, stolen 50-caliber machine guns, airplanes purchased on false premises and flown overseas, explosives, and they got into trouble because they were endangering dock workers. They were mislabeling boxes and crates full of explosives as machinery, and when a few of them fell onto the piers, they were picked up by the FBI, which quickly unraveled and traced back many of the organizational affiliations to legitimate charities. So by violating the Arms Export Control Act and Neutrality Act, the government began to crack down and pretty much scared many of these front companies into shutting down, or after the state was formed, becoming legitimate purchasing agencies for the new government. So there's a whole slew of these conventional smuggling fronts that were active, and the one that concerns us the most, there's a 7,000-page file at the National Archives with pictures of the airplanes and all sorts of interesting documents. All of this was put into a book. But Weston Trading Company and Marine Surveyors is the one that we're going to focus on real quickly. Was there any call for accountability for the conventional smuggling? Yes. Norman Dacey, who is a really activist lawyer who got into a lot of trouble for challenging state planners and writing books, also tapped the Justice Department and State Department to crack down and do some prosecutions. And they wouldn't do it. They said, look, you can go out and hire some lawyers and do legal research and see if there's a statute of limitations that hasn't run. And they basically blew him off, and there were never any real prosecutions of the smuggling network. So what did David Lowenthal do as his first job, as future leader of Apollo Industries? He ran blockades on the Exodus. He fought in Israel's War of Independence. He was closely tied to the future head of Israeli intelligence. There are photographs of him in the desert with Ben-Gurion and Moshe Dayan, leaders. And he really was an illustrious and innovative person. The idea behind the Exodus, the ship that Rudolf Sonnenberg saw off personally with David Lowenthal on it, was to harass and bring all sorts of displaced persons, harass the British, bring displaced persons into Palestine. It was an expert at reflagging, tapping fueling networks, and doing all sorts of things to publicize the fight for state. They were extremely effective. So this is the man who's in charge of Apollo Industries by 1958. Close personal friend of Zalman Shapiro. They lived on the same street here in Pittsburgh. And he maintained regular contact and getting briefings on military affairs during the entire period that he was active in Apollo Industries. He was also in Israel during all of the key decision points for going nuclear, including when it decided to foreign source material in other countries. He was active in WZO, the ZOA's parent organization, United Jewish Appeal Missions. He had access to funding for critical missions, although it's not clear any of that funding went into Apollo. But clearly he acquired it somewhere. So Apollo Steel was this giant steel plant, defunct, full of boilers, full of cranes, and it provided Newmex's first place to reprocess uranium. In fact, Lowenthal and Shapiro shared offices. They occupied the same facilities. And the Newmec was able to quickly begin getting regional investment from the state and local investment organizations, so that now they're really tied into the community. If they failed, Kiske Valley would be in serious trouble because of loan guarantees. The core process of this plant, this steel facility that suddenly entered the nuclear industry, was this: taking hexafluoride gas, it came from these giant facilities with centrifuges and separating out uranium hexafluoride and converting it into fuel pellets. That was their core business activity to give pellets to the nuclear navy to power the ships and submarines. And its comparative advantage from a business standpoint was almost exclusively tied up in the fact that Shapiro was this brilliant person who had solved so many problems that he could continue to get government contracts for the Navy, and his courtship of the head of the key regulator. It also didn't hurt that the workforce in Apollo, out-of-work steelworkers, were extremely easy to replace and didn't want to rock the boats, so their wages were nothing to attract anybody in terms of compensation. Why did they go to Parks and Apollo? If you look at the entire sort of file, including the allegations and documentation of material movements out of the country, it was certainly also involved the easy access to New York piers, the ability to ship stuff out on LL cargo flights, which they did, and the strong presence of, again, the ZOA, which provided so much of their leadership. So nuclear regulation in the 50s and 60s was kind of a joke. The Atoms for Peace program of the Eisenhower administration was trying to shift the focus away from all of these hydrogen bomb tests and towards civilian applications and even transferring material out of the country to help other countries establish peaceful programs. And so a law came into effect in 54 which provided a 10-year window, in which the government would almost abandon supply any processing company with nuclear fuel, not charge them for it, except for a small lease that they would pay until they returned it in the form of finished product. So this is the window in which NUMEC was operating. One author correctly noted recently in a book about the Atomic Energy Commission, which was what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does today, as kind of a joke. It was trying to promote industry and regulate it, and it didn't do either very well. And it was extremely dictatorial in pushing around suppliers because of its regulatory power. Charles Keller of the Energy Department was in charge of overseeing NUMEC. He quickly noted that they didn't have very good record keeping, or at least in Apollo. They were running another facility for the government in Niagara, in New York, in Lewiston, where they did a great job. But for some reason, in Apollo, they did a horrible job. He noted, jealously, I think, that they were receiving payments for contracts they hadn't completed for the government, that they had a fire that released all sorts of radiation into the environment. But in this period of time, they didn't alert the public. They didn't even visit as regulators of NUMEC. So the Atomic Energy Commission suddenly started to realize that NUMEC had security problems. They cited it twice in January of 1962. They were going to shut it down. NUMEC was working on fuel for satellites and the Navy and the NERVA. If you want to look that up, you'll see a steampunk engine that's fueled by plutonium, which is extremely interesting, but you never want to see it flying over your house. But at the same time, there was also something going on overseas. The Israelis were also very interested in obtaining U-235 to assemble gun-type, Hiroshima-type weapons. And also, two physicists have noted in a Bulletin of Atomic Scientists article that they would have been interested in U-235 to drive Dimona. So there's a courtship going on between this man, Uber lobbyist Abraham Feinberg, the guy who was most responsible for financing Truman's election campaign, and Glenn Seaborg, the genius Nobel laureate who invented plutonium. And in terms of fundraising and publicity, he also turned his attention not just to financing and getting close to presidents, but also raising money for the Wiseman Institute, which counterintelligence files, Pentagon studies, researchers have identified as a key behind financing the Israeli nuclear weapons program. Feinberg even paid
the American Israel Public Affairs Committee chief to publish some disinformation in the early 60s while the Kennedy administration was trying to inspect Dimona, publishing articles with expert opinions that Israel could certainly never go nuclear because it just didn't have the industrial base to enter the atomic club. So there's a lot of moving pieces of which NUMEC was one. The Weizmann Institute then, according to the Pentagon itself, quickly went beyond these simple technologies into enrichment with laser technologies and designing and modeling weapons using supercomputers. Rickover quickly became tired of NUMEC. He contacted Shapiro twice in the early 1960s saying that security was a mess, that it wasn't a good idea 2 years after incorporating to bring in Israeli scientists to work on plutonium work. He tried to shape the site up, but he was unsuccessful. At the same time, because of the Atoms for Peace program, the Atomic Energy Commission was sending sensitive material all over the world. Colombia, Pakistan, Israel, 320 grams of plutonium for irradiators. And so NUMEC was in this business. They were shipping all over the world. But it wasn't always clear exactly what they were shipping. And we'll get into that in a second when we talk about the irradiators. So when did this come onto the map as a diversion problem? In 1964, they received 1,000 kilograms of bomb-grade U-235. This was after they complained that 400 kilograms wasn't enough to complete a complex fuel job, and they took on all responsibility for the material. In 1965, they were struggling to return finished product. There was a lot of input into NUMEC and not enough output. And so the AEC, being the kind regulator promoting nuclear industry, allowed them to shift material from other contracts to make up the losses. But they were going to be fined. And suddenly, when the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy of Congress got involved, the AEC suddenly was on the spot. They had to explain why their contractor was losing so much weapons-grade uranium and what was happening to it. So they put together a meeting in which Seaborg and his key agency heads simply came up with a theory that NUMEC had been accumulating losses by passing them on contract to contract, and like a Ponzi scheme, when that supply was cut off, suddenly they had this massive loss that they couldn't account for. And in fact, that's what they said to Congress. But they also began to realize internally at this point, and you can see this in the Seaborg papers at the Library of Congress, that maybe just trusting companies wasn't such a good idea. Maybe they needed real safeguards on all this material. So Seaborg told everybody at this meeting, here's the front we're going to take. This is the position we're taking. And this is the position that continues today, officially. We support the belief that there's no diversion that had taken place at NUMEC. Although in private, he argued to his author, his biographer, Benjamin Loeb, you know, maybe I've been too arguing their case too hard all of these years. But what happened? The FBI is responsible for investigating Atomic Energy Act violations. The Atomic Energy Commission talked them out of doing that, but the FBI went ahead just investigating the plant as a foreign agent anyway. Because they saw some activities that they didn't like. When Zalman Shapiro talked to the FBI, he explained that he had this curious joint venture that he had formed just years after setting up NUMEC. Here's the joint venture. The Israeli Atomic Energy Commission had 50% equity in ISORAD. NUMEC had 50% equity as well. What were they designing and shipping? Irradiators, according to Zalman Shapiro. The purpose of this particular joint venture was sending equipment that could be used to pasteurize and irradiate fruit to extend the shelf life. But, unfortunately, we now know, according to many researchers, including Abner Cohen, that this was simply a front for Rafael and Dimona. This was a front organization to be able to send weapons scientists overseas to get sensitive technologies. And so NUMEC's Israeli partners in their joint venture were Joseph Eyal, who worked out of the same division as the Scientific and Economic and Covert Operations Bureau called the COM. This is the bureau that ran Jonathan Pollard against the United States, which was formed by Benjamin Bloomberg, who Shapiro knew intimately. So this is NUMEC's joint partner, this little company up the northern, right up north, up the road. The GAO got involved looking at NUMEC. They didn't want to rely on the Atomic Energy Commission anymore. They said this is a much more serious matter. And then we finally started getting news reporting. Although here's a typical news report. In the U.S. edition of the New York Times is the staid and somewhat docile headline, "Uranium losses spur drive for tighter U.S. control of fissionable materials." The Paris edition, however, screamed, "U.S. plant loses 100 kilos of U-235. This is kind of typical of most of the reporting that's taken place. The article didn't even mention NUMEC, didn't mention Pennsylvania. So the AEC on the spot knows that it's going to bankrupt NUMEC by fining it, but it has to because Congress is on the case. It dangles a contract to an oil company to take this mess off its hands. And it sells it on the idea of buying it as a precondition to getting lucrative five-year contracts. So Apollo Industries is a fly spec, you know, $8 million in revenue per year, competing against giants like General Electric. It didn't have the wherewithal to continue. So the AEC forced Atlantic Richfield to buy NUMEC, assume all of its liabilities, and then it could begin to manage a lucrative facility. ARCO had no nuclear materials experience, and they wrote it into the contract. The original owners of NUMEC, for their 10 years of work, cashed out with $10 million. And Atlantic Richfield, again, in the notes in the purchasing contract, was named as eligible for the contract because of buying NUMEC. So this is what happened to this problem back in the 60s. The interesting thing is that ARCO didn't really value NUMEC. It never integrated it. It gave back ISOMAD. It saw that as a problem and maintained it as a separate company until it could spin it off. This is the moment in time when the CIA gets involved and alerts the president, "Now we've looked into this NUMEC affair, and it's our estimate that plant material has been diverted from the Israeli nuclear weapons program." And they begin tailing and tapping Shapiro. Shapiro, meanwhile, was inviting people into the plant, even though he was now reporting to Atlantic Richfield. Some of the people he had into the plant were Avraham Armoni, who was in charge of the nuclear weapons program in Israel, Ephraim Begin, Avraham Ben-Dor, who were intelligence operatives, Raphael Eaton, the head of the COM network. All of these people went into NUMEC undercover at the invitation of Shapiro in 1968. Is Raphael Eaton a chemist? No. He's a pretty brave guy. He managed to snatch a Nazi war criminal single-handedly off the streets of Buenos Aires, but he's not a chemist. What were they doing at NUMEC in 1968? The FBI also saw Shapiro having strange meetings at his homes with Israeli nuclear scientists, and he was saying troubling things on wiretaps, that he prioritized Israel over America, that he'd rather fight over there because he thought their cause was in peril. And so the FBI is becoming more and more concerned about Shapiro's visitors, including clandestine meetings in the Pittsburgh airport, that he couldn't explain what he was called out on it. So Shapiro begins to chafe under Atlantic Richfield's ownership. He tells some Israeli government officials that he's going to take off pretty soon, and they try and convince him to stay because he's valuable in his present position. But Atlantic Richfield was canceling all of these Israeli businesses and shipping him to Europe to drum up business, and he didn't want to continue there. Meanwhile, the FBI put him in the security index saying, this guy's a threat to the United States. So what happened? I'm not going to go over this, except as an example that through these wiretaps, the FBI actually tapped instances where illegal storage up in Apollo was leading to massive spills that they were trying to cover up. This wiretap, which was released in 2010, shows that after suffering a leak due to out-of-compliance storage, they hired a bunch of new people after the old ones cleaned up the mess. They were relying on the weather to clean it up as well, including a thunderstorm to wash away the contamination. So there's a lot of insight into how the plant was being run. The CIA was brought in because they couldn't really understand David Lowenthal's continuing contacts, visits, and phone calls over to Israel. But then this first investigation was shut down. It was shut down because the Nixon administration finally understood that this foreign country was going nuclear and there's nothing they could do about it. So the most they could do is follow Kissinger's advice in not being shown to actually have complicity in it by pretending that it didn't exist. In this famous agreement in 1969, they adopt strategic or nuclear ambiguity and pretend that because the U.S. isn't ever going to talk about this, that it doesn't exist. The problem doesn't exist. And it was purely political. In the Yorba Linda Nixon Library transcripts released in 2010, Kissinger says, hey, even if we withhold jet fighters and say, hey, you can't have these unless you shut down this program, there'll just be a big political campaign against us in the U.S. And we won't even be able to explain why we're being tough and mean and miserly. So this shuts down the investigation. Shapiro resigns from NUMEC. He immediately, although he's a fuel specialist, instead of launching another business with his $3 million in stock that he got, immediately joins Henweki Borelco and starts demanding that the AEC upgrade the security clearance so he can work and get access to H-bomb designs. Beryllium is used to boost and miniaturize hydrogen bombs. This is where field specialist Armin Shapiro wanted to work. The Nixon administration was apoplectic. They said, there's no way we're going to let him work in that position. But they were deferential as well. Shapiro, because of his continuing contacts with Caramoni, who the FBI knew was involved in nuclear development, had him in the security index, but Shapiro was determined to fight, hired a lawyer, and the AEC had to do what it did best, pressure somebody into hiring him away into a position with no security clearances. So the first investigation of NUMEC ends. Babcock and Wilcox acquires it. It's a company with no value because they actually had to be paid to take it over. But Babcock and Wilcox, the present owner, responsible for a lot of the cleanup right now, wanted to preserve Navy contracts. It was a boiler manufacturer since 1916. It makes the mistake of absorbing NUMEC into its operations in 1974. And this is another big company with $1 billion in shipments. Getting NUMEC for reasons that didn't entirely jive with just pure business motivations. The end of the Nixon sort of period of investigation was when Glenn Seaborg was paid a tenth of his annual salary and had an honorarium to give at the Waldorf Astoria the annual address of the Wiseman Institute, side by side with the chief North American fundraising coordinator for the nuclear weapons program, Imran Feinberg. And he used the opportunity to buttress strategic ambiguity by saying, you know, everyone was always asking me about this funny plant in Israel and whether they were going to have a bomb. And I should have told them, you know, it's a nuclear power, but it's the type of nuclear power that makes use of the atom for peace. And that was Seaborg's official position until he died. But the Ford administration didn't let the investigation die. There was a assistant to the president by the name of Conyers who wanted access to the CIA's file on NUMEC because there is continually pressure from Congress to resolve what had happened in the decade earlier. And so, to their horror, a CIA briefer goes into the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and tells them, yes, it's our official position that Israel's first bombs, which were manufactured and ready for deployment before Dimona went critical, were fueled by material from NUMEC. But it's our estimate that because Dimona is now operational, it doesn't matter. They're a nuclear power. Live with it. Forget about it. Obviously not in the law enforcement accountability business. Here's another instance where NUMEC, as John Fialca, a reporter, once called it, becomes a self-sealing problem because the director of the Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner ultimately and immediately says to the CIA, God, if I'd known you were going to say that, we wouldn't have so many people in the room. What if this gets out? I should have restricted attendance more. Fortunately, though, the National Resources Defense Fund requested a copy of the document, along with a lot of other organizations in the 70s, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission accidentally leaked a page detailing all of these uncomfortable facts from the CIA briefing, and that's now on the web for reading. It's extremely interesting. Attorney General Edward Leavy said, okay, there's obviously been a major dysfunction here. I want there to be an investigation of government cover-up. I want an investigation of diversion. We're going to interview 100 people through the FBI. We're going to find out what happened to the material, and we're going to prosecute the people responsible. They trained CIA officials to detect the signature of NUMEX material, which was 98% Portsmouth U-235, that you could actually pick up in soil samples and determine where it came from. And in 1977, they wanted to polygraph Shapiro, but they were denied that right. Shapiro interviewed with the FBI, didn't tell them anything. But two visitors did go to Glenn Seaborg's office, and they told him outright, and this is noted in his journal, that traces of HEU from NUMEC were picked up in Israel. Glenn Seaborg notes this calmly in his journal. When the FBI calls him to follow up and ask about all of the failures to regulate NUMEC, he says that he will not meet with them and he never meets with them again. The General Accounting Office, now the Government Accountability Office, at the request of John Dingell, was putting together a report for public release that would finally assuage public cries for accountability that were coming into Congress. The name of that report is Nuclear Diversion in the U.S., 13 Years of Contradiction and Confusion. We obtained access and put that out in 2010. At the time, it was the CIA that denied release of the report. And when they gave us the report, all of the CIA material was redacted. So there's an interesting moment in this investigation that was taking place at the end of the Carter administration. They finally got a break. They talked to a trucker and an equipment operator. The equipment operator who went out to smoke on the loading dock witnessed Shapiro and unknown others loading canisters of U-235 into equipment bound for Israel. He gave this testimony, binding testimony, actionable testimony, to the FBI. The truck driver noted that he was always rushing shipments for loading onto Zim ships. They never used a bonded warehouse. He was impressed with the extreme efficiency with which they would get these irradiators out of the United States. And this is what one of those designs looks like. You put together the irradiator. It has all sorts of warning symbols on it, but you're not supposed to actually ship sources inside of it. So if they were loading material into equipment, that was something even the AEC didn't allow for safety concerns. In the book, we take all of these observations and calculate what the actual mass of the uranium that would have been shipped overseas might have been. And it's substantial. The current Energy Department estimates of material unaccounted for put NUMEC in the record books.
They lost 269 kilograms in between 57 and 68, and 76 afterwards. They had higher throughput after the period of Shapiro's reign. So while he was involved in all of this, they lost about 2% of everything that came into the plant. After he left, it went back down to industry norms of 0.2%. And according to this audit, Newmec sticks out like a sore thumb in the materials unaccounted for record books. There are a lot of people, though, who continue to push the story that all of the material was recovered. When Seymour Hersh talked to Zalman Shapiro for his wonderful book, The Samson Option, he actually wrote that, hey, all the material was recovered when the plants were finally taken down by Babcock and Wilcox and ground up and separated. And that's not true. Only 95 kilograms were recovered, leaving an outstanding balance of material that went in but didn't come out. And this is even counting processing losses of 337 kilos. Last week, the National Archives began releasing Carter administration documents, which revealed that they had consulted thousands of pages of CIA files in the interest of having a bona fide prosecution of Zalman Shapiro for obstruction of justice. But the actual summary of all those CIA documents was taken out, which is pretty normal. Happens a lot. These withdrawal notices are red construction paper. And you can kind of see why in the file. They, in the same file as the Newmec case, have the case of SECO, which is another nuclear processing facility that they thought would go out of business if they criminally prosecuted for some safeguards issues. And they also had the Camp David peace accords to preserve this historic peace between Egypt and Israel. And so they didn't, in the end, prosecute, and they didn't even pass the file to the Reagan administration. This is the end of the Newmec affair. Or is it? The agencies are continuing to fight release. This is one of the documents released last week, in which they promise internally that they're going to finally issue public statements and close the investigations, and they're unable to do so. And so this is getting into now my pulpit about freedom of information and nuclear ambiguity. The Obama administration, when talking about whether violent video games are impacting any of these school shootups, made these two statements: we don't benefit from ignorance, we don't benefit from not knowing. I think it's time to apply those principles to the Newmec affair and start questioning some of the directives that are still suppressing, all of the access to the key documents, the top shelf stuff of the Carter administration, where they've gathered together all the information and finally summarized it. And I'm going to go through and tell you which documents those are, because now we know. But Obama continues to express ignorance. Again, I already made this quote. When he was asked about weapons and where they came from, he doesn't know. Timothy Naftali was on C-SPAN a couple of weeks ago. He was a former archivist of the Nixon Library. And even though he wrote a book about Nixon and had access, supposedly, to documents, he actually didn't, because the people he wanted to interview and the documents he wanted to use in the interest of preserving legacy, he couldn't get access to them. So, what do we do? There are new declassification tools. Obama, as soon as he came into office, said in a press release, you know, agencies should adopt a presumption of openness when people are asking for secret information. And I can tell you, doing FOIA requests for 10 years, that has radically changed access to information that was formerly tightly held. So that's good. And he also did an executive order saying basically that there's now an expiration date on classified documents. If you classify a document as a government agency today, you should assume that it's going to be public in 25 years. So this, if you apply it retroactively, means most of the Newmec documents should have been out years ago.
Mandatory declassification reviews are another way of asking for information. Much more tedious. Reporters don't use it because it takes years of efforts and close tracking. But it allows you to, instead of going to court for documents and suing and spending money, to simply say to an outside review panel that you've been denied access and you want access. And so the ICECAP panel, composed of various officials who can check each other and the National Archives, are there for people who want access to information. And nobody has ever appealed NUMEC files to this panel. This is a panel that has a record of releasing 60% of the content of documents that people have wanted. No one's ever made it to the ICECAP panel until now. So here are some documents that are just in the regular old FOIA pipeline. The Carter administration's assessment, compiled from CIA documents, visits of spies, NSC files on the nuclear program. Here are things that they have to make an up or down decision and either abide by their openness principles or forever accept the fact that maybe there are some things they're not ever going to release. These are in the hands of the ICECAP panel after years of efforts in doing appeals and asking for documents. David Lowenthal's CIA file. What was this guy doing overseas? There's a 200-page FBI file, 75% which is redacted because it's CIA information. A huge file from the National Security Agency of wiretap information about proliferation. It's called Proliferation of Apollo, Pennsylvania, 77-79. Discussions of the first warnings to LBJ. We know what LBJ was told about NUMEC because it's cross-referenced in other documents. But now the actual files are due for release, if they decide so. And the CIA's full briefing to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, among other things. So, the situation, and here I'm bringing in the Wiseman Institute again, you know, when you're fighting for overturning the bans on document releases, you're basically attacking the principle of strategic ambiguity. And the organizations and individuals who would prefer that not to happen are as strong, if not stronger, than they were in the 60s. The Wiseman Institute has board overlap with officials of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. They feature them in their meetings. They're not going to be happy if strategic ambiguity is challenged. I'm not going to go into all the new information that's come out about them and their role in nuclear weapons financing, which call into question the tax-exempt status of their local U.S. fundraising arm. So let me just get into what's going on in Apollo. Here are some of the cases that have been filed in the Western District Court of Pennsylvania where people have sued for wrongful death, property damage, health damage, and are fighting for compensation for their injuries. Most of these suits have the individuals with their limited resources fighting against Arnold and Porter, LLP. And they're premised on the fact that, or the belief that NUMEC was a legitimate operation and not a front company. Arnold and Porter has been the key lawyer of the Israeli government since 1967. They get $10,000 a year for special projects. They defend all Israeli officials against criminal suits in the U.S. They also tried, they've won numerous cases. So these small Apollo residents are going off against a juggernaut. They've defended Zalman Shapiro since the 1970s in all of his investigations. They also tried to rehabilitate him by filing for a presidential award of technology innovation, which he certainly deserves if you only look at the Nautilus activity. It's paid millions of dollars. And this is the firm that just happens to be on the other side of all of the NUMEC lawsuits in Pennsylvania. How did that happen? This is just a little bit more about this bid to kind of rehabilitate Shapiro. They basically brought in Arlen Specter and told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission you must give a clean bill of health to Zalman, have it filed in the FBI files, because his reputation has been tarnished by all these investigations. To its credit, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said, no, what we know about NUMEC is that there's a lot of material missing, and we're not taking a position on diversion, but we're not going to give anybody a clean bill of health. Problems with the current cleanup, though, I think, and many people who write about this have mentioned, is that we don't know everything about NUMEC. New information keeps coming out about it. These 200 barrels that were unknown to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, for example. And we think that American taxpayers, to the extent that more information comes out, might resent paying $500 million for the cleanup. But the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers seems to be aware that they don't want to be the latest patsy for any failures to clean up the huge toxic waste dump up in Apollo and Parks Township. And they recently, in December, met with the CIA, NSA, National Security Council, and other organizations in Washington about Apollo and the cleanup. Well, these aren't guys in the toxic cleanup business, so what was that meeting about? We still don't know. But the problem with getting NUMEC documents is that you're going up straight against nuclear ambiguity. You're fighting this 1971 policy that says everyone has to be hush-hush about these issues. And this is in spite of the fact that although the U.S. has kept its mouth closed for the most part, except for Jimmy Carter, who when he left office said, oh yeah, they've got 150 nukes to the BBC. But generally, U.S. presidents have abided by this. Israel has been known to violate it. They conducted tests that were detected by the Vela satellite system. Sasha Polakow-Saransky, a Council of Foreign Relations fellow, disclosed this document 2 years ago, which was Shimon Peres offering nuclear tip Jericho's to apartheid South Africa government. So they haven't really abided by their end of the deal anyway. But by fighting for these documents, you're going up against this long-established policy. And so what we believe is that this is thwarting these civil suits. It's not allowing them to take all of the parties to court. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to talk any more about that. But breaking down this brick wall of strategic ambiguity is more than just about NUMEC. But it might lead to peace. One of the things that the Central Intelligence Agency has long said is that all of these weapons might thwart peace by having, by lessening the sense of needing to compromise. So a little bit more openness about this issue kind of offers a symmetrical solution as well. The U.S. isn't supposed to even supply foreign aid to nuclear countries without a waiver. Every time we send a check to Pakistan, under the Symington and Glenn amendments to the U.S. foreign aid legislation, the president has to sign a waiver saying it's okay. We don't observe that because we pretend there's no problem. So, basically, there's a real interesting, I think, opportunity in Apollo. Nothing really happened with the conventional weapon smuggling funds. They were either integrated and turned into legitimate purchasing organizations, or they collapsed. NUMEC isn't even like other nuclear weapons smuggling funds, and there are. Milco was one out of California smuggling nuclear triggers. There were prosecutions, and it was shut down. Telegy is another front company that was shut down in 2010 for exporting Textronix oscillators without proper licenses and redirecting them overseas. So basically, this is both a slide and a question. What would accountability over this look like? We think that some of these environmental damage claims should be paid for by organizations like the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission and perhaps some of the overseas entities behind it. We think there should be full declassification of all remaining NUMEC files. And this is what I was up in Apollo talking about yesterday, that if they want access to this, if they want to redirect some of their requests for damages, then they need to take on ambiguity as well. Because it's kind of a big piece of old newspaper wrapping up this particular rotting fish of policy. The challenge, though, is finding the right vehicle. You know, how do you actually do that? Can you even sue a government for this kind of thing? I don't know. I don't think it's ever been done before. How did they sue O.J. Simpson after he was found, you know, not guilty of murder? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. But there's clearly been a channeling of responsibility for this issue that's buttressed by secrecy. So we've launched a website kind of wrapping up the entire issue called endambiguity.com, which allows people to sign on to all of our declassification drives so that when we send them in, they bear the name and address of people from Apollo, saying, hey, you know, we have a stake in tearing down ambiguity and getting access to documents. It allows me to talk to people who have more expertise about maybe finding better ways to file better court cases, and keeps people updated on the progress against strategic ambiguity. So my whole privilege in going to Apollo yesterday was the idea that the very first need for nuclear ambiguity sprang from the discovery that there was a problem at Apollo. And so it's entirely appropriate that key challenges to this old policy be in a safe city. And with that, I've skipped a few slides, and I've definitely gone over a few minutes of time here, but if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Thank you.